Welcome to KiteLine, a weekly radio program on WFHB that focuses on issues in Indiana's prison system and beyond.
I'm Emma Johnson.
And I'm Mia Beach.
And we're your hosts for this program.
Behind the prison walls, a message is called a kite. Whispered words, a note passed hand to hand, a request submitted to the guards for medical care. Illicit or not, sending a kite means trusting that other people will bear it farther along until it reaches its destination. Here in KiteLine, we hope to share these messages with you across the prison walls.
Red Fawn is a 37-year-old Oglala Lakota Sioux woman from Denver, Colorado. A prominent organizer and tireless helper inside the Standing Rock camp, she was arrested on October 27th during the resistance to a police raid. She was charged with attempted murder and accused of firing a gun after the police who were restraining her were apparently startled by the loud pops from nearby police weapons discharges. She's currently facing 20 years in prison. Next week, we devote our episode to Red Fawn and have exclusive coverage of her story from those who know her.
A research and policy center called In the Public Interest has reported that financial documents filed with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission over the past 10 years reveal that six Wall Street banks play major roles in financing the two main private prison companies' debts. Those companies, CoreCivic and Geo Group, depend on debt financing in the form of credit, loans, and bonds to conduct their daily business operations and to acquire smaller companies. At the end of June, CoreCivic and Geo Group each had a total debt of over $1 billion. The six banks involved in financing these private prison companies are Bank of America, JP Morgan Chase, BNP Paribas, SunTrust, US Bancorp, and Wells Fargo. They've extended a revolving credit to CoreCivic and Geo Group, provided them with term loans, and underwritten their bonds. By providing CCA and Geo Group with debt financing and by collecting interest and fees on outstanding debt, the banks contribute to, enable, and profit from mass incarceration and the criminalization of immigration.
Solitary confinement may be losing its luster in the eyes of prison officials. In October, New Jersey's elected officials voted to halt isolating prisoners, often for as long as 23 hours a day for months or years at a time, after deciding that such isolation was abusive and made it harder for inmates to return to their communities. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie hasn't yet signed the bill. If he did, juvenile, pregnant, elderly, mentally ill, gay and transgender prisoners would no longer experience solitary confinement in state prisons and local jails because it can be especially harmful to those inmates. Solitary would be a last resort for all other prisoners. It would last no more than 15 days at a time, and a physician, clinical psychologist, or psychiatric nurse would have to monitor those inmates. A recent United Nations report found that the use of solitary confinement in U.S. prisons amounted to torture and was what the organization called a human rights crisis.
According to The Guardian, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, has banned small children from playing with crayons in the visitation area at the Geo Group's Immigration Detention Center in Carne City, Texas. The company, which is the second largest private prison corporation in the U.S., and which has made over $57 million from the center since November 2015, claims that children damaged a table with crayons while their mothers were receiving legal advice. 600 women and children are detained at the center. Lawyers for them say the move to prevent children from playing with crayons is unfairly punitive. In a letter to Immigration and Customs Enforcement, a member of the Refugee and Immigrant Center for Education and Legal Services, which offers pro bono legal aid to detainees at Carnes, said that treating small children's crayons markings on a table as destruction of property is inappropriate and that such markings are one of the costs of locking up children.
In Harmanli, Bulgaria, hundreds of refugees clashed with riot police while attempting to escape their detention center. Tires and mattresses were set on fire. Earlier, xenophobic neighbors of the camp had spread fears in the town that refugees were spreading skin diseases, leading the formerly open refugee camp to be turned into a closed prison. It took less than a week for the refugees to rebel. In nearby Istanbul, 50 refugees lit fires in a closed detention center in order to cover their escape. Cops fired live warning shots in an effort to intimidate them. This week, we return to our coverage exploring women and incarceration. First, we hear a bit from a conversation between Nicole Siegel, where she speaks with Anna and Michelle, two prisoners who've been doing research on the Indiana Women's Prison. You can hear more from Anna and Michelle in Episode 9, the first installment of our Women in Prison episode series. If you haven't had a chance to hear that episode, you can find it on our website. Here are Anna, Michelle, and Nicole having a discussion about the history of the Indiana Women's Prison.
The early questions that we have, so we look at the annual reports and we're reading what's in front of us and we're looking at these prison records, and there are things that are just standing out by nature of the fact that we live this life and we're here, that do not make sense to us because we've had this actual experience. When we were looking at the context of 19th century and what was happening in this time frame, and there was this enormous campaign against female sexuality in any and all contexts.
Wow.
And these reformers in particular crusading against sex workers, that prostitutes were the evil that was just going to take down society. So, you know,
moral panic, anybody?
Right, yes. You know, I believe Michelle had read something somewhere about Indianapolis being inundated with prostitutes.
Wow, the classic flood imagery.
Michelle, in her brilliance of digitizing the numbers, starts to go, whoa, wait a minute. There's nobody on a sex-related fence incarcerated
at the reformatory,
for the first 24 years.
But meanwhile, so, there's this major sex panic discourse about sex workers.
And this, indeed, is what people like Sarah Smith and Rhoda Coffin were out there campaigning against.
So you were like, hey, what's going on here? There's an imbalance. Why are they declaiming against sex workers on the one hand and not incarcerating any on the other?
Well, particularly when this is one of the points that you're going to use to get your female reformatory for women and girls. You, by nature, being a quote-unquote virtuous woman.
Because it didn't exist yet.
No.
Where were women housed with men? Oh, they were housed with men.
They were housed
at
with
Jeffersonville.
Men. Yes. And Michelle could talk more extensively on the sexual violence that happened at Jeffersonville, being the catalyst then for these reformers to say, oh my God, these horrible atrocities, all this sex with these women, babies running around the prison. This is horrible. We need a separate institution.
Okay.
We as virtuous women will make these non-virtuous, sexually deviant women into virtuous women by nature of our benevolent reform.
Right.
So there's no prostitutes here. And, you know,
for 24 years.
For 24 years, absolutely. And so this is the first red flag. Wait a minute, there's no prostitutes here.
It became, where are they? You know, we had our researcher go back, Monique, go back, and she's great. We had her check jail records. They weren't there. That led to the discovery that there was the Home for Friendless Women that had opened. And that there was the Magdalene Laundries, a Catholic convent ran by the Sisters of the Good Shepherd, and that that was where a huge majority of the women were located. And this was huge because women convicted in criminal courts weren't being sent to the prison. They were being sent to a convent.
Why? Why did they send them to the Magdalene Laundries instead of the Indiana Reformatory?
Labor.
Labor?
Labor.
The Catholics needed the labor.
Absolutely.
Yes. But didn't Rhoda Coffin and Sarah Smith want the sex workers at their prison so they could have their labor?
Absolutely. But I think for their reforming efforts, right? I wonder if there was not a deal.
And human trafficking.
Oh, my God.
You know,
you keep the sex workers.
Sex workers. And I actually said something else. And you keep the murderers and thieves. It was I wonder if it was an actual division, an actual communicated thing, because they actually, the Catholic convent was actually in communication because they were vying for the same piece of land.
Right.
And why?
The land was owned by the Catholics originally.
The land where this prison was originally built.
Where the Home for Friendless Women was.
The home,
yes.
So they were in communication.
So the Catholics had a little edge on them.
Yes, and they were first. They were approached first to take these women that were inundating Indianapolis and following the soldiers and all of that.
Why do you think the Catholics wanted the sex workers?
It was part of their particular mission with the Magdalene Laundries. The Magdalene Laundries was their philosophical or religious goal to create this place where women, Magdalenes, which is prostitutes from the Christian tradition, right, could wash away their sins physically and spiritually in service in this convent. So
and
it
these
was
were
their capital A,
international
number one.
It's the extension of, you know, what Nathaniel Hawthorne would consider the Scarlet Letter. That these were women whose virtue was tainted by being sexually promiscuous, by becoming pregnant out of wedlock, by desiring sex, by deviating from any of those ideologies of what a woman was supposed to be physically and sexually. So
absolutely,
sex for a woman was a punishable crime. And so you deserved to be in servitude, to wash away your sins.
And without criminal conviction in some cases, right? Fathers dropping them off, priests dropping them off, and other family members. So some women were
at
there
the Magdalene Laundries.
At the Magdalene Laundries weren't convicted of crimes. Criminal crimes, social crimes. They were out of wedlock. They were too pretty, even, in particularly in Ireland. Some of them went there for just being too pretty.
I think this adds a really complex and interesting dimension to our understanding of the history of prisons in the United States.
Absolutely.
These local, particular, very micro political conflicts between factions, like in this case, Protestants versus Catholics, and the ways in which this division of the policing of women's sexuality and criminality accomplished a kind of compromise or a truce between these two competing factions of elites.
Fundamental institutions in the state.
Right.
These little moments in time, right after the Civil War, created institutions, benevolent institutions, institution after institution after. And one of their main goals was hierarchy and dividing and parceling out where women are.
Compartmentalizing.
Absolutely.
So the Protestants and the Catholics came together to police women's bodies.
Absolutely.
So what happened after those 24 years? And after 24 years, then you start seeing sex crimes in the book of records of the reformatory.
Right.
So what happened? Did the Catholics give up the ghost? Did the Magdalene Laundries close? Did the Catholics lose political power?
I wonder if it had to do with the growth of the city. And that there were too many.
Right? There were just too many for the Magdalene Laundries to absorb.
It's possible, because the registry, lots of women coming in and out of the Magdalene Laundries.
You know, I think there's the other element, too, that the Indiana Reformatory for Girls was a state-funded and a state-run institution. So although there was this undercurrent of religion happening, because these were Quaker reformers who opened this institution, they were hand in hand politically.
Right.
And so as the political tide shifted and changed, power weighed more heavily on the quote unquote state as opposed to religion and the church. And I think that was part of the shift and how things
secularization evolved.
Yeah.
Urbanization.
Absolutely.
Population growth.
Absolutely.
The growth of Indianapolis as an urban center.
Yeah. I think that's so interesting. I think you're really on it, because even the Magdalene Laundries didn't close till 1967, but they're removed sort of from the popular narrative of the Indianapolis, the great Indianapolis.
You know, what you guys are showing through your research, in part, I think, is once again how the history of prisons is so important to the history of everything else.
Absolutely.
The history of U.S. urban life.
This makes me think of Emma Thornborough's text, The Negro in Indiana Before 1900. And I'm reading this text, and I see her thorough analysis of every aspect of Black life.
When was this book written?
In the 1960s.
Okay. So it's in our lifetimes, but not written yesterday.
Absolutely. And it's a historical text, one of the only available about Indiana and Black Americans. And what is missing in this text is any conversation about crime and prisons.
Yeah.
And And you know this is an issue. You know it's a concern. This is Indiana. Right. But you can't find it. It is one of the challenging things about doing research on race and prisons, because the connection isn't very clear after, prior to a certain point, if you're trying to dig through and find those early connections. And we're doing it. We're doing the work, but it's one of those interesting challenges.
Why is that absent from this narrative?
I think in the 1960s, there was an importance to communicate African-American history and go with a positive storyline to reclaim. It's part of a reclamation of the negative messages that have been said about African-Americans for years and years and years and years. And so part, that whole genre, that whole era, seems to be, we're only going to tell you the good stuff.
Right.
And here's
we're not
going to
air our dirty laundry.
We're not going to air our dirty laundry. We need to tell us the good stuff right now. Right. And I think she's part of that tradition. Love her. But
really that, important work, right?
Really important work. I mean, I wouldn't understand a lot of things about early Indiana and race without her. But I think that's why.
Up next, we speak with someone out west who does prisoner support for several different female prisoners, as well as works on a publication called Unstoppable. She speaks briefly about Unstoppable and also what she's learned about the conditions of female prisoners. We'd like to warn listeners of upsetting content in the following segment.
Unstoppable publication was birthed about a year ago, and the intention is that we wanted to sort of highlight the resistance that is happening in women's facilities and among trans women prisoners who are housed at men's prisons. And so explicitly anti-authoritarian publication that has contributions from prisoners across the United States, so it is nationwide. And it also contains contributions from folks on the outside. So we wanted to sort of facilitate some type of dialogue between, you know, political readers on the outside and then folks who are on the inside. And so we've put out one edition so far, and that can be found on unstoppablepublication.noblogs.org. And we're working on putting out a second publication. Oftentimes, what we've experienced working with folks in women's prisons is that we're dealing with a community of survivors of not only state violence by way of locking them up and putting them in prison, but also survivors of patriarchal violence or, you know, other kinds of traumatic abuses that folks on the outside have perpetuated against them since they were little kids, oftentimes. So, you know, there are like pretty horrendous stories out there of women just as a small kid, like in the home, experiencing pretty abusive conditions and then, you know, having to fend for herself on the streets and then ending up in an abusive environment like prison. So those, you know, wounds are quite raw and open for folks when they're in prison, oftentimes because they're not able to self-medicate. And also, if they need medication, oftentimes they're not getting the appropriate medication for any, like, neurodivergence or mental health issues that they're experiencing. And we do see a heightened rate of mental health reports from women in prison. So it's something like 75 to 80% of mental health rates. And so, you know, I'm working directly with a couple of prisons out in the western part of the United States, and both of those prisons are grossly understaffed with mental health counselors. For example, there's one prison with 600 women, and there's only two counselors. And so I'm hearing stories that, you know, folks are trying to, like, ride in for a therapy session, you know, send a kite to get seen and perhaps get medication if that's what they need. And, you know, they'll get a 5-minute meeting with the counselor and then, given some coloring pages and then sent on their way. So this has led to some pretty unfortunate suicides and self-harm. And so, unfortunately, it's really hard for them to kind of get the help that they need while they're incarcerated. Cutting is a really big method of self-harm that's happening, and also bulimia. At one of the prisons I've been working with, there's this sort of like sudden rise of folks reporting that they're bulimic. And so, I've known a couple of folks who have been found either in the process of cutting or their bunkmate has told on them, and then they are thrown into the hole or put on suicide watch where they're strip searched and left in a small cell with none of their property and just sort of watched indefinitely until they say that they're better. And so, yeah, they're absolutely punished when they're attempting to seek help. And not only are they not receiving treatment, being punished by these formal mechanisms, but they're also being taunted and bullied by correctional officers. You know, recently there was a suicide at one of the prisons that we do work at, and the guards were mockingly dropping candy from the third tier after the suicide, which is how she ended up killing herself. She jumped off of the third tier and they dropped candy bars and said, oops, you know, to sort of like make light of the incident, which also creates this hostile culture, right, for anyone else who perhaps witnessed or heard about the suicide and then see correctional officers doing that. You know, it's like the enemy is always around them. This was a woman who had a charge of harming her baby. And so in women's prisons, that's one of those charges that is the equivalent of, let's say, a child molestation charge in a men's prison. It's something that will certainly put that woman on blast, and other prisoners, you know, don't look highly upon that. And so she had been bullied and she had been locked up for over a decade, but had made some great progress with folks and ended up, you know, developing some meaningful relationships. She ended up being told that she could not receive the medication that she had been receiving prior to that point for her schizophrenia. And so she was taken off the medication for some reason. We still don't know what that was. And, you know, she had been putting in kites for mental health help, like immediate help, because she felt suicidal. Her friends knew that she felt suicidal. So there was one day where her friends were trying to keep a watch on her, and she was trying to make it up to the third tier. They knew exactly why she was doing that. So they were trying to keep her away, and somehow she escaped their watch, made it to the third tier. And while that was happening, prisoners were screaming for correctional officers to come and help, and no one came. They just sort of like sat in their tower. And a content warning for folks who are perhaps sensitive to this: when she's on the third tier, there are other prisoners who are grabbing mattresses from the first floor cells and grabbing, you know, pulling them out to try to catch her fall. And she makes it to an area where there is no mattress. She jumps and breaks her neck and is laying there for 20 minutes. Again, no correctional officer came, or no help came. Nothing happened. So the other prisoners just sort of had to sit with her while she died 20 minutes later. You know, like I said, there is a lot of past trauma among folks who are incarcerated at women's prisons, which is also similar to men who are incarcerated in men's prisons. It just appears to be perhaps more talked about and also more prevalent at women's prisons. But that aside, there seems to be, you know, just this culture of shame, right? Self-induced shame, and then shame that comes from the family members and other prisoners. In any women's facility, you've got 2/3 of them who are mothers of children under the age of 18. And so the idea that these folks are bad mothers, that sort of message is given to them over and over and over again, and a lot of them believe it, right? That even if they were committing a crime of survival, to keep their family, you know, together. Ultimately, they're given the message, especially by their family members, that they were a bad mother because they ended up getting locked up. And so, you know, there's a lot at stake for women to hold their families together while they're incarcerated and to sort of make up for any past harm they feel like they have done. And so when that comes to political action, sometimes that can be a sort of an obstacle because the idea is, well, if I take this political action, will I compromise my visits, right? Or will I compromise my access to the phone so that I can keep in contact with either my children or my family? And so that's, you know, the burden of having to be the caretaker, the mother, the partner, the wife, and the daughter that still is upon women, even while they're incarcerated, and even more so. And also in prison, you know, there's this prison programming is a total nightmare, and it's a lot of sort of self-help driven classes or classes that attempt to get prisoners to dissect their thinking patterns so that they might learn how to become better people once they leave. And what I found and what's been reported by a lot of women who have taken these classes is that it just continues to vilify them and continues to put the blame entirely upon them and ignore all of the social context that came before that, right? Like the racist, homophobic, and patriarchal society that perhaps put them in a situation where their backs were against the wall and they had to make a decision that ultimately got them locked up.
This has been KiteLine. Anyone affected by the prison system in any form is welcome to write us via our P.O. Box, KiteLine Radio, P.O. Box 2422, Bloomington, Indiana, 47402. KiteLine wants your feedback. You can reach us via email at kitelineradio@gmail.com or find us on Facebook. Are you or someone you care about affected by the prison system? You can call us to record a message to be played on the air at 812-269-2512. Or you can use this number to record a message to a loved one behind bars. You can hear previous episodes of our show or get more information on the prisoners or stories covered on KiteLine at our website, kitelineradio.noblogs.org. You can also find our podcast on iTunes. KiteLine is intended as a means of communication between people across prison walls. We are not responsible for all views expressed on the program. WFHB, its contributors, or any affiliates airing this program are not responsible for the views expressed on the show. This has been KiteLine. Join us every Friday at 5:30 p.m. for more stories, news, and insights about the impact of prison on our communities. Thank you for listening.